discovered by a German named Heinrich Schliemann, who came to Greece via Troy. He had made millions and millions of dollars by himself in the fur trade in the Soviet Union. He was involved in the gold exploration at Zutter's Mill in California during the big gold rush, American gold rush. He came back with his own multi-million dollar bank account, and he had been, since a child, very interested in the Trojan War, the story of Agamemnon going to Troy to bring back Helen, who had been taken off by Paris. And he excavated out at Troy for several years, dug very many large holes there, found a great deal of treasure, especially gold and jewelry, which he spirited out of the country, which made him persona non grata in Turkey. He then turned his attention to the other focus of the Trojan Wars, and that was the city of Mycenae. The city of Mycenae is the city from which Agamemnon, the leader of the most ships and the largest contingent of soldiers, it was his homeland, and he marshaled all of the troops of peninsula Greece, and including two or three cities in Crete, and took them off to Troy to fight against the Trojans. He came to Mycenae, which was still known as right there in the northeast corner of the Peloponnesus in the Argive Plain, and he excavated there as well as he did in Troy, and again was dumbfounding the scientific, then scientific world with the amount of gold that he was able to pull out of that one particular site. During his excavations, in addition to finding the citadel, very thick wall citadel of Mycenae, as it was described, thick walled Mycenae in the Iliad, he also dug a series of tombs, and they produced a spectacular amount of gold. I'm referring to practically everything on your right-hand side of the page, gold and silver inlaid daggers, and this mask, a gold death mask that you see on your upper right, which, as he looked at it, he thought that he had looked in the eyes of Agamemnon, his great hero of childhood, and cabled back to his father, "Today I have looked in the eyes of Agamemnon." This did a great amount to inspire the romanticism of archaeology in Europe, and he continued to dig at other sites in Greece, producing fabulously wealthy contexts and always gold and beautifully worked gold, not just gaudy bangles of gold, but intricately worked inlays of gold, silver, copper, and other items. He called this whole culture that he found here in mainland Greece after the city that he dug first, Mycenae, and talked about a Mycenaean kingdom, the Mycenaean period in Greece. Basically, this is what we would call the Late Bronze Age in the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean. Just after, and slightly overlapping with Schliemann's work at Mycenae, another very wealthy Englishman came down and dug in Crete, this long 250-mile east-to-west island that blocks the southern entrance to the Aegean Sea. This man was Sir Arthur Evans, who had been keeper of antiquities at the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford. He had been very interested in small little seal stones that kept appearing in private collections, and he started to make a catalog of these. Some of these had writing on them, and he came to Crete in order to find the homeland of these seals with their writing and try to figure out what kind of a civilization had once existed in Crete. The first place he went to was Knossos, which is on the north coast, right in the center of the island, just east of the modern city of Heraklion, and well, southeast of the modern city of Heraklion and southwest of the American air base there. And he came there and was able to buy several of these seal stones from the local populace. He was absolutely intrigued with these things. He went back, raised money, and came down, pumping his own millions into it, and excavated over 13 and a half acres of a palace at Knossos, which again showed an excellent, brilliant culture that flourished at about the same time as the civilization of Mycenae on the northeastern corner of the Argive Plain in peninsula Greece. These are the two pioneers, Evans and Schliemann, of Aegean archaeology, and these two cities, Mycenae on the mainland and Knossos on the north coast of Crete, are again the two foci, basically, of the Aegean civilization. Evans found out that around 1450 BC, something had happened to his palace at Knossos. It was absolutely ravished. The building walls had been knocked down, setting timbers ablaze, and he looked around for an explanation for this, and the only thing he could see was after this destruction, there seemed to be pottery with a mainland Greek appearance to it, much more like what they were making on the mainland than they were making in Crete. And so he developed a theory that around 1450 BC, the Mycenaeans from their citadels in mainland Greece, all thick-walled as the Iliad tells us, came down and destroyed all of these cities of Crete, which were by nature unwalled. There is no walled city in Crete because open palaces are flat land. And it was his opinion that these warlike Mycenaeans came down and destroyed the Cretans around 1450 BC. Who were the Mycenaeans? What were they doing there? Excavations in the southwest corner of the Peloponnesus at a site called Pylos or Pylos. Just before the first wall, Rohr gave us hundreds and hundreds of tablets in clay written in a linear language, not a pictographic or a hieroglyphic language, but a linear language, just as we basically, the same type of writing that we might print today. And these were deciphered by a group of people, including a man named Chadwick, and it was found out that these were Greek. In other words, the Mycenaeans were Greek. He pushed back the arrival of the Greeks by almost 250 years. The Greeks did not come down around 1100 BC from the north. They were already in Greece 1500 or 1450 BC, and perhaps even earlier. So we know that we have Mycenaean Greek speakers here. After the destruction of 1450, Crete has tablets, so we have Mycenaean Greeks there. So we can talk basically of an Aegean Greek or a Mycenaean Greek situation from about 1450 BC to about 1200 BC, when all of the Eastern Mediterranean suffers a complete destruction from which it takes it over 150 years to recuperate. So by Levant, I'm talking in the broadest sense of Anatolia all the way around to Egypt, and Aegean again, the mainland, peninsula Greece, the island of Crete, and if we were to go into a detail, in detail, the Cyclades islands that float about, or look, seem to float about, Sea itself. Those then are the parameters of what we'll be looking at tonight. The second thing I wanted to do is to mention that we are going to be talking about an area that we can relate to what's happening in Egypt, the Aegean, and also to basic Syro-Palestinian chronology. The first period in Palestine, when we get into the Late Bronze Age, is called LD1, and this equates to Mycenaean 1 and 2. Each of these countries has a tripartite structure to their chronology. You'll have early bronze, middle bronze, late bronze, and early bronze 1, early bronze 2, early bronze 3. And if you broke it, it would be A, B, and C, etc. Same as the same situation you have in the Aegean, where you have Mycenaean 1, 2, and 3, Minoan 1, 2, and 3, etc. So these line up, and we can equate from pottery exports from Greece to Palestine the various cultures. Therefore, Late Bronze 1 is Mycenaean 1 to 2. It starts around 1570 BC and goes down to 1400. Ahmose is the Egyptian pharaoh that drove out the Hyksos, the Middle Bronze Age Hyksos, of which you probably first spoke in here. And Thutmosis IV closes this period. The Late Bronze 2A period in Palestine is equivalent to Mycenaean 3A. And I won't do too much with chronology. I just want you to have some idea of how these dovetail together. In Egypt, this is the period of a rather extreme pharaoh, Amenhotep III, and an even more extreme pharaoh, Amenhotep IV, whom you might know as by his other name, Akhenaten, who went out from the capital of Thebes and set up his own palace at Tell el-Amarna, introducing the Amarna period of Egypt, which has often been called one of the most beautifully built and elaborately planned cities in all of Egypt. I had an Egyptology professor at Chicago who claimed it to be one of the most rapidly built lunatic asylums in all of Egyptian history. If you're not familiar with Akhenaten, you're probably familiar with one of his close relatives. The exact correlation is a little bit cloudy. Tutankhamun, I've just placed him down here under the terrible abbreviation of Tut, to Palestine, and we have the 19th dynasty in Egypt, and this is Mycenaean 3B in the Aegean lands. And basically what we'll be looking at is material that floods into Syria and Palestine and Turkey and Egypt between 1400 BC and 1200 BC. This is a system of absolute chronology, which is based on pottery. Basically, if you look at this cabinet here, you'll see some very nice bits and pieces of pottery. They'll all be given names. I can see iron 2C Persian, iron 2AB. These mean nothing. They're relative chronologies. It would be like if you took a 1950 Ford and a 1960 Ford, and you had a photograph in a newspaper that said this is our new 1950 model, our new 1960 model, and then you had a picture of a 1953 and a 57 Ford, you could somehow fit them in between. You have two knowns. Stylistically, these seem to fit. And that's basically the way this cabinet is arranged. Then on these tags, you also have absolute dates. It will say something like 1400 or 1300 BC. This is done by plugging your relative chronology, which is basically a relative typology. It's how the type changes, say, from 1950 to 60 in the case of our imaginary Ford. It is plugging this relative chronology into the better-known records of Egyptian history. The Egyptians were excellent record keepers, and much of their history is recorded to the year or to the month, sometimes to the day. And with a little bit of argumentation or conflict, you can usually date things fairly well according to Egyptian chronology. The problem is that with the Aegean material, you have to have a Greek import in Egypt or in a context in Palestine that we know is controlled by a certain Egyptian pharaoh or destroyed by one in order to synchronize the two or the three or the four areas. So we deal basically with Egyptian chronology for our absolute dates, 1400, 1300, etc., and then a relative typology to plug the sequence of pottery within those parameters, absolute parameters. Another problem, other than the problem of absolute versus relative date, is that basically archaeologists deal with these little critters, which you've probably seen. These are sherds, potsherds, and people will get, myself to blame also, absolutely enraptured in shuffling a bunch of little broken pieces of pottery around, calling out absolute dates, and this is such and such, and this and that. And usually that's a bowl, that's a jar, that's such and such, and that's where it stops. And what I'm trying to give you an idea tonight is that you can do more with pottery than simply say, oh, that's an EB1A, probably from the northern part of the country. You'll see people cut these things, and they draw pictures of them, and they want to know what the sherd would have been part of, and you usually just take one of these things and you put it on a board until you can't see any light, and that gives you an idea that that vessel was shaped like that. It wasn't like this or like this or like that. It was a vessel that looked like that. Actually, what you're dealing with here in this sherd is something that's been basically kept in the corner since I've been here, and that's a big pot like this. It's a hole called a whole mouth jar, because the mouth of the jar looks like it has a hole in it. It's not very elaborate, but you can then take the jump from a little sherd here, which can help us. I'm not slamming dating these things, because that's basically what I work with. But one, I think, has to make the jump from this sort of thing to something like that over there. And then, once you know what it is, you can say, well, what would you use that for? It's certainly not a glass or a coffee cup or something like that. It is a storage jar. It's a domestic thing, probably something you'd have in your house, or grain or some other commodity. And what does this, the use of this pottery, tell us about the culture that we're dealing with? Now, in order to illustrate this, I would like to take about a 10-minute, rather fanciful at times, but I hope this will come together at the end, because it may look like six of one combined, but I think there is a point to this thing, and I hope it comes together at the end. What I'd like to do is look at some material from a fanciful future excavation in Amman, and we have a box of pottery, which always has to be covered with plastic, and always has to have a tag in it, and we find that this is the Yarmouk University excavations in Amman, and that the site that we have, the ceramics and other things, from the mid to late 20th century AD. In other words, what I want to do is look at a few bits of pottery from this imaginary site with an eye to how you can tell the nature of the fragments which you pick up on the surface, which you excavate from a tell, or which you find in a tomb. Basically, we're fairly lucky with this imaginary site. I was able to go through the textual material that we've found, that Yarmouth University found with it, and we have one fragment here that says OF, or, and it has Oriental, and then RES, that is burnt. You can't see the rest of it, but it has 7-0 Jebel Amman, Amman, Jordan. We know this is a late second millennium AD site, so it probably dates to 1970. Because of the 7-0 there. Oriental is very similar to many of the pieces of ceramics that we find here. We know from their own language that this is called China, and so that works very well with Oriental. I'm giving you both the foibles and the practicality. So we want to run this to the basic extreme, and this is beating it in the ground, believe me. We also have some contemporary documents, which some of you may recognize. We have Res, Taiwan Turismo. We have Res, the first Chinese Res. Most of these tablets are texts of damage. There's a scholar, Abdullah Noel Friedman, who's now working at Yarmouth. I don't know whether you know him, but thinks that this Res that we get here is from a reserve in which these Chinese Oriental people would have been kept during the end of the second millennium BC. And we do know that there was more than one of them. There was not just one in Amman. Here's Mand, which we couldn't interpret until we found the other tablet has Mandarin. And we see that Chinese Res again. And we see there's one in Amman and one in Aqaba. So we have a pretty good idea of the type of people that inhabited this building. We could go a little bit further and show you where they lived. This was actually paper that was excavated from a piece of metal in a large white box, which we're interpreting as the Holy of Holies, must show their original homeland and perhaps some sacrifices to their deities. Well, that is a preliminary introduction and far-fetched, but you'd be surprised if you read some archaeological reports how that could be much further-fetched. Here we have a piece, if we had a fragment, there would many people would be very happy. We've got the whole thing here. This is a plate. Everybody can see it's a plate. Naturally, if this is exported to some place, this is an export of tableware. There's no commodity that you could put in this. People are exporting tableware. And I'll just whip this off and give you a quick run-through of this, and then we'll look at the Mycenaean equivalents of this. Most archaeologists deal with their pottery from most open form to most closed. Take a milk bottle and that plate, and those are the two extremes. Here we have something else which is more closed, but it's still in open form. This would represent an export in tableware. No contents, no commodities involved in that. And we can continue on with something that's, again, more closed. Very good iron II form in shape, not in glass. Again, it's more closed, but it's, again, tableware. No commodities being involved. Other things like this with a handle shows a morphological variation of the thing, which allows the user's hand to stay away from the heat of the cup, unless some cultures want the heat of the cup, and therefore you hold the teacup in your hand. This is a variant. You'll see one of these from Mycenae that I'll show you in a minute. It's a large vessel that's starting to become closed. It has a definite rim here, but again, I don't think you'd be dealing with a container if you were to excavate this. This is, again, tableware. If we were to remember those pictures of the thing excavated from the sanctuary, an archaeologist would have a field day with this particular piece of art. It would be a cult item, guaranteed. Keeping up with the open forms, here we have something we all understand as a glass. Morphologically, if you see a whole plate of pottery, a whole publication of pottery, you'll have it set up typologically. Now, in many people's typologies, these two would end up on the same page. You have this very square form, flat base, straight sides. This one has a plain rim. This one has something a little bit different on the rim with a little ridge around it. Now, looking back on it, we know what these two are, but you're looking back 2,000 years, it's important to be able to differentiate. This form are not identical. This would show a trade in tableware. This would suggest, perhaps, that this could be capped or a lid, and therefore there's a contents in it. And if you went another step further and had something again with a ridge, but with a little bit of diagonal stripe to it, has a little bit of a shoulder here, and then you find your top, and you see this is a container. And when you reach this, you're reaching something completely different from this. This is pottery that's being exported for tableware. This had something in it. And you can go beyond the fragments of pots, sherds, to the commodity that was in it, and this should help to give you, or at least you should ask the question, how can this help us to tell what these people were trading back and forth? I don't want to be any further into the ground, but we have another very closed form here, straight side, shoulder, and morphologically differentiated at the top, a little rim, a rim below it, and you can see that these can come in two different sizes. You look at their rims, they're very similar, but basically they have closed containers for a certain item which has been secured at the top for transport. The bottom will date it, the bottom will tell you a lot of things about the culture. It's the inside that will give you the extra 50 or 60%. Again, if you saw something like this being exported, if you ever try to price better ones than this, because we got downtown, you know, these are very expensive. This is a difficult type of item to ship. So it's going to be a luxury good, and it's going to be only the people that can afford it, and the amount of breakage on something like that would be very high indeed. If we could have the first slide, David, I'd like to take a look at Mycenaean pottery and look at Mycenaean pottery with this sort of extreme view of what we're dealing with in antiquity and see how we can relate it to what's happening between Crete and mainland Greece and what is happening with the coast of Syria-Palestine coming all the way in to Oman and up into Syria. I'm going to leave this light on because I think that on most of these slides you can see both the map and the projected image, and so I'll keep them both on for that reason. Here we have a Mycenaean jar, and this is an extremely beautiful fabric. The clay of which Mycenaean pottery is made, if you take, this happens to be early bronze, but if you look in the late Bronze Age cabinet, you will find nothing that is as well made as Mycenaean Greek pottery. It was traded all the way as far west as Sicily and all the way as far east as, well, past Oman and down all the way into Nubia, into the Sudan in Egypt. It's very well made, very quickly decorated. It's an export type of pottery, but it sticks out immediately, and that's from local pottery, and that's why it's given such high marks in the dating end of things. Can we have the next, please? Now, this is just to give you an idea of how the distribution of this pottery comes inland. These are sites that have ceramic units, and that's any type of fragment of Mycenaean pottery, less than 10. There are a lot more. You don't see Oman Airport on here because it has a great deal many more than 10. But it gives you an idea how thickly the sites are grouped that receive this Mycenaean pottery. And remember, this stuff is being traded all the way across the open Mediterranean, or maybe transshipped through Cyprus, etc. It's coming a long way. It is a sought-after thing, just as some of the pieces here might have been in other cultures. Can we have the next, please? Here is a series of the open forms. Again, I said the most archaeologists group in open and closed forms. Here are the open forms that are traded into Syria-Palestine. There are about 70 different types of pottery altogether that are traded in. This chart and the one that will follow, I've cut down to just the shapes that occur more than five times in order to get the mainstream of the trade. The whole typology of this Mycenaean pottery was worked out by a Scandinavian scholar named Furumar, who divided all of the different known Mycenaean pottery into what he called FS forms, Furimark shapes. So you'll see little numbers here, and I'll refer to them. And these are the numbers that Furimark gave to particular shapes. He then, after he worked out his various chronologies, he went to Egypt and to Palestine, several Palestinian sites that had Egyptian datings for them, and he gave us this absolute chronology that you see on the right-hand side of this. We just look down here, and this is why I brought out such absurd things as the coffee cups, teacups. This is a trade in fine tableware. It's luxuryware. It's not being traded for self. Contents is being traded for self. This, if you remember, the wine glass, some of these things here, the large casserole. This is a funnel form. It's open at the bottom. These all give you good examples that tableware were being traded basically from Greece into Palestine. What I want to do is really look in detail with you to the at the closed forms. Grab the next, please. And here you see them here. There's a whole group of juglets here that are called stirrup jars that we'll look at in a minute, a group of things that are called flasks. Then we have a couple of pieces that are called piriform jars because their profile is a inverted pear shaped. And then we have a couple of other little things. These two here only occur 7 times, so we're not going to deal with them. They just made it over my arbitrary cutoff of 5 occurrences. Grab the next, please. This is that stirrup jar I was telling you about. I'll just cut the light for a moment to point out something that it is very specific. If you snickered at the gravy boat, you'll see that the gravy boat is a piece of pottery that is very specific in shape. It has 2 ends here, so you put a ladle in either end of it. It's glued off part of the floor. It's all one piece, so you don't get the tablecloth, etc., dirty. It is a very specific piece, and the specific elements of this are functionally. They're for a functional purpose, so you don't stain the table, that you don't, that you can get the ladle in and out. This is a very specific form. It's a little globular jar that would be about 8 to 10 inches high. Nothing fancy about that, but if you look at the top part, the part that gives it the name stirrup jar or stirrup jug, it has a spout with a small diameter, and then it has a false, what's called a false spout or a peg up here at the top. Then it has handles on either side. In German, it's called a Bürgelkanne stirrup jar. And that name is stuck in its English translation, and these are called stirrup jars. But this is a very specific way of putting handles on a jar. Can we have the next table, please? If you look at the various Furmark shapes, and that's what all of these numbers are, and this is white out, it's not the painting of the wall that you see behind here, you can see that no matter how the shape of the bottom part of the vessel will change, the top part always has that same thing. Some of these are straight on, others are in profile. Well, they all have a real spout that's offset at the shoulder, a straight spout there, a false spout with the handles on either side of it. This is very specific. You don't see this in any other type of vessel. And no matter how the potter makes his, the bottom of the vessel, the top always remains the same. Grab the next, please. And this is my interpretation of why this was so practical. Here you have the stirrup jar. You just put your 2 fingers in the stirrups, your thumb over that disc, and the weight of the liquid that was inside it just tips the vessel for you and would pour it out very nicely. Notice that you have a small diameter here, and we could probably posit that this was for a thin, pourable liquid, just like the beer bottles and Coke bottles that we have in this imaginary assembly. Can we have the next, please? There is another closed form that you see left and right here, a Mycenaean pottery that's very similar to the stirrup jar and very well represented in our Palestinian and Syrian context. You can see it has a true spout. It doesn't have a false spout, and the handles are connected to the true spout. It's related, but it is not the same. It has a diameter of a spout that's the same as you get in the stirrup jars, and you could also probably suggest that this would be for a thin, pourable oil as well. Do we have next? This shows you 3 different forms of these little flasks, all of them, the top part, no matter how the body changed, there's something very morphologically specific about the upper portion of the vessel, and this will not change whatsoever. Remember that they can appear little globular ones like that, or they can appear in very flat clamshell-like ones, as you see on the top. Can we have the next, please? Another vessel shape that I'd like to look at with you is called a piriform jar. Its body is like an inverted pear, and you can see that its body tapers down in the pear shape, has a constricted neck, a brim that comes way out like that, it's sort of O-splayed, sticks out, And then it has three items. You can see two, the third one would be right behind there, that have often been interpreted as handles. And so when I use handles, I'll use handles in quote. This is a large vessel that is about a foot and a half high, and it is mirrored in shape by some smaller vessels. Could we have the next plate? Here you have these. These are about 10, 11 inches high. They're also called a form jar. They share various forms in the lower body, but again, as we saw with the last one, the top part has a constricted neck and a wide outsplayed mouth. Next, please. Now, I'm showing you the bottoms of two vessels. We've just looked at a bunch of Mycenaean pottery, and here are two of them. They've been purposely, the top has been taken off. I'd just like you to look at it for a second, and then we'll have the next one, please. And I wasn't showing you two similar vessels, I was showing you two completely different vessels. Although from here down, they're absolutely identical. But here you have one of those stirrup jars, which we know from the Linear B Greek tablets was an oil vessel. And here you have something else identical on the bottom, but it has this completely different top. If we know that this is designed, or we think we know it was an oil jar, I say it's specifically designed for thin pourable oil, I wonder why we can't posit that this was for a thicker or more viscous, similar substance, maybe an unguent or something like that. Here you would have a vessel or a commodity that would be poured out, and here you would have something that would be extracted, i.e. you would stick your fingers in it or a spoon or something else to get the unguent out of it. Could we have the next, please? Here are three tops of three vessels. Again, they look pretty similar when we look at them this way, but if we look at the complete vessel data, we see that we're dealing with something.